All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a case. It's really gonna hit home for everyone. I mean, we've all been there, right? When a deal just, it feels off, like something's not right.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That feeling of, did I just get taken?
Exactly. Well, this case, Siester v. Banta, from way back in 1965, from the Iowa Supreme Court, it really digs into that whole mess. It's about this blurry line between like buyer beware and protecting people from, you know, sales tactics that are just plain wrong, even if they sign on the dotted line.
Yeah, and it brings up this huge question, right? Like, when does the law step in and say, nope, this is too far? Even if someone agreed to it. We're going deep on this one, folks. We've got excerpts from this really in-depth analysis of the case, a full-on case brief, the works, so we can really, you know, pick apart this decision and see what it's all about.
Perfect. Let's start with the story itself, the human side of this whole thing. We've got Agnes Siester, a widow in her 60s, living in Des Moines, Iowa. And then we've got Wally Arthur Murray Dance Studio. Over a number of years, this studio, they lay it on thick. Flattery, promises, the whole nine yards. They basically tell her she could be a professional dancer. Sounds crazy, right?
It does. And the thing is, she bought it. We're talking over 4,000 hours of dance lessons, three lifetime memberships. The total's over $29,000. I mean, come on, think about it. Yeah. A woman in her 60s, a professional dancer. It just doesn't add up. It's not like, oh, maybe she's got some hidden talent. It feels more like they knew what they were doing.
It does. And that's what's interesting, right? Our sources are saying that the studio was in on it the whole time. They weren't actually thinking, oh, yeah, she's got a shot. It was a strategy. But then things change, right? Agnes's favorite instructor, he gets fired. And that's when it hits her. Wait a minute. Was I misled this whole time? And that's when she decides to sue, get her money back.
Right. And here's where it gets even more complicated. The studio, they don't try to defend their sales methods in court, at least not right away. What they do is they rehire that instructor, the one Agnes liked so much, and they send him to her. The goal, convince her to drop the lawsuit and sign some, well, settlement agreements. So she's going after them legally. And they're like, hey, how about we just settle this whole thing?
Yeah. And with that first settlement, she got some money back, $6,090 to be exact. But what's wild is that the studio called it a refund for an unconscionable overcharge. So basically, they're admitting right there, they charged her way too much. It's almost like they're saying, yeah, we kind of ripped her off. Then there's a second settlement for $4,000. And get this, they never actually paid her that.
So basically, she drops the lawsuit based on promises that, well, weren't completely kept. And this is what leads us to round two in court. She sues them again, but this time it's different. Now she's claiming that the original sales and the settlements were all messed up because of fraud, because they lied to her.
And the court, they listened to her story, looked at the evidence, and they sided with her. They gave her $14,300 in actual damages, you know, to make up for the money she lost. But then on top of that, they hit the studio with another $40,000. Punitive damages, they call it. That's a big chunk of change. It seems like they were trying to send a message.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That kind of money, it's not just about covering her losses. It's about punishing the studio for what they did. And more importantly, it's a warning to others. Like, don't even think about doing this because we'll come after you. The court wasn't playing around. And of course, the dance studio, they weren't happy about this at all. So they appealed, took it to the Iowa Supreme Court. They basically said, there's not enough proof of fraud. The settlements are valid and the damages are way too high.
So let's get to the good part, right? What did the Iowa Supreme Court actually decide? First, the big question, fraud. Did they agree with the lower court?
They did. They agreed that the studio had committed fraud. They looked at the whole picture and said, this studio, they were intentionally taking advantage of this woman. And the way they did it, those crazy promises about her becoming a professional dancer, that was a key part of it. The court was like, come on, this wasn't just sales talk. They knew she wasn't going to be a professional dancer, and they used that to trick her.
And the court also thought that it was reasonable for her to believe them. I mean, if someone you trust keeps telling you you're great at something, you're going to start believing it, especially if you're, you know, feeling a bit vulnerable. And that belief, that's what led her to spend all that money on those lessons.
Exactly. And you know what? One of the briefs actually quotes the jury, and they call it a predatory play on the vanity and credulity of an old lady. Wow, that's pretty harsh, but it gets the point across. The Supreme Court, they definitely agreed with that sentiment. And another important thing, they basically said, buyer beware doesn't apply here. You can't use that as an excuse to cheat people. They were very clear about that.
So that buyer beware idea, it has limits, especially when the seller is being dishonest. That's a big deal for anyone studying law, right? It shows how the law balances things out.
Huge.
Yeah.
It's not a free pass for businesses to do whatever they want. Okay, so fraud, that's stuck. But what about those settlement agreements? The studio must have been hoping those would save them.
They were, but no dice. The Iowa Supreme Court said both of those releases were invalid. Remember the first one where she got some money back? Well, the court said it wasn't enough. It was just a partial refund for what they already considered a ripoff. It wasn't a fair trade for her giving up her right to sue them for everything.
Right. And that second release, the one for $4,000 that they never even paid, that was even worse. She basically gave up her legal rights for, well, nothing.
It's like they weren't even trying to be subtle about it.
And on top of that, the court didn't like how the studio got those releases.
Yeah.
They pointed out that the studio specifically brought back that instructor to, you know, sway Agnes. And there were even hints that they were messing with her ability to talk to her lawyer. The court said this wasn't a fair deal. It was basically fraudulent overreaching, as one of the briefs puts it.
Okay, so we've got fraud in the original sales and then these shady settlements. The studio is really digging themselves a hole here. Now, back to the damages. The lower court gave her actual damages, which makes sense. That's for the money she lost. But then there was that huge $40,000 in punitive damages. What was the Supreme Court's reasoning for keeping that?
Well, they were very clear about it. Those punitive damages, they're not about making Agnes whole again. It's about making the studio pay for what they did and, you know, making sure no one else tries this. They said the studio showed shocking greed and basically didn't care about Agnes at all. They wanted to make a statement. You can't exploit vulnerable people and get away with it. That $40,000, it was a message loud and clear.
And it wasn't just the majority opinion that emphasized that point. There was also a concurring opinion from two of the justices, Thompson and Stewart. What did they add to the conversation?
Yeah, they really zeroed in on the ethics of the whole thing. They agreed about the fraud and the releases being invalid, but they wanted to make it very clear that the studio had done something morally wrong. They called what the studio did unconscionable and demonstrably exploitative. They really highlighted the ethical side of this case, which is, you know, really important to think about. Law and ethics, they often go hand in hand.
Absolutely. So let's wrap this up. What are the big takeaways from Saestra v. Banta? What should our listeners, all you future lawyers out there, what should you be thinking about?
A few things. First, fraud can totally blow up a contract or a settlement, even if everyone signed it. Second, that whole buyer beware thing, it's not a free pass, especially when you're dealing with people who might be more vulnerable. And finally, those punitive damages, they're a powerful tool, not just for punishing bad behavior, but also for preventing it in the future. This case, it really shows how the courts try to make things fair, especially when one side has more power than the other.
And I think it's so relevant today, right? You think about all those pushy salespeople, those scams targeting older people, or those loans that are designed to trap people. Saestra v. Banta, it really laid the groundwork for how courts deal with those situations.
Definitely. It's a blueprint for protecting people who might not be on equal footing when they make a deal, especially when someone's trying to pull a fast one.
So as we end our deep dive into Saestra v. Banta, I think the big thing to remember is just because something's written down and signed doesn't mean it's fair or legal.
Right. This case shows us that courts are willing to look beyond the paperwork if something just isn't right, ethically speaking. And for all of you listening, think about that when you're out there practicing law. You're going to see this kind of thing again and again.
It's all about making sure justice is served, not just following the letter of the law. Understanding cases like this one, it helps us fight against exploitation wherever it pops up. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Until next time.